The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
On today's episode, we'll be talking about two controversial topics in an evidence-based way, as we do. Later on in the show, we'll speak to science librarian John Dupuy about some recent Canadian science library closures. But let's start out with an audience request to dig deep into fracking. Enjoy. Welcome to Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Rosenberg. Andrew is the director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's served on multiple federal scientific advisory bodies and is a professor of natural resources and the environment at the University of New Hampshire. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Desiree. Nice to be here.
Now, why are we hearing so much about fracking lately? Is this a new process or...?
It's not an entirely new process, but the way that it's being deployed and the access it's given to what are called unconventional oil and gas resources is really transforming the energy sector. So it's not a new process in that the kinds of drilling and then trying to break up the rock down deep with water or and chemicals has existed for many years. What's changed is that the technology to horizontally drill and then to use very large quantities of water or fluids at very high pressure has opened up a lot more shale oil and gas resources than have ever been accessible before. And that has resulted in a boom in natural gas and oil coming from shale rock, which was previously inaccessible.
And you mentioned that it was an unconventional method. So what does that mean?
Well, it's unconventional in the sense that these were resources that were not accessible before. Before, drillers had to find a place where the oil or gas would collect and then pump from that locale. What they're doing now is they're breaking up the shale, creating all kinds of fractures in shale down at quite deep depths. So there's a shale layer that's deep rock. They're creating fractures which allow oil, gas, and other materials to migrate along to now these very long horizontally drilled wells. And so they can collect from a much larger area as opposed to pooled oil. Again, I mean, I should emphasize I'm not a geologist or a, oil and gas engineer, but the basic process is simply breaking up rock that was previously inaccessible for most drilling.
And how do they break up that rock?
Well, they use a mix of, there's several different methods as I understand it. They use a mix of water and chemicals. Sometimes they use acid. There are other methods for well stimulation that, again, are, horizontally drilled. So they drill down and then horizontally to access a very broad layer of rock. They use very high pressure injection that effectively breaks up the rock. They include in it what's called a proppant, which is usually silica sand, that holds open the cracks so that the oil and or gas can flow. And then they collect that within the well, the horizontally drilled well, pump it back to the surface along with anything else that came up, the fluid they injected, the oil and gas they're extracting, any other material that happens to, including water that comes up from those very deep layers.
Unconventional. It's an unconventional method. Are there other unconventional methods?
Sometimes in the industry, people use the term fracking quite narrowly to mean the operation of actually injecting at high pressure water and chemicals. There are other unconventional methods such as acidization, which is trying to do somewhat the same thing except using acid to break up the rock. Also injected, again, under high volume and high pressure, but a slightly different process. And again, the details of the process I don't know. But again, the unconventional part is it's accessing resources that were mostly unavailable prior to having this technology, particularly the horizontal drilling at very high volume, high pressure.
So basically, someone would choose fracking if the oil and gas is just really, really difficult to get to.
Yeah. And so in North America, there are very, very extensive shale deposits. So there's the Marcellus shale in the northeast. There's the Bakken shale in, you know, the mountain states in Montana, Wyoming area. There's Eagle Ford shale and so on around the country. These are very large shale layers, which have very large deposits of sometimes mostly oil, sometimes gas, sometimes both. There's the Monterey shale in California. These are very large rock formations that yielded oil or gas in the past, but most of them were inaccessible. But now that you can horizontally drill, you know, very long distances, you can actually access most of the resource. So they're now extracting oil that people might have known was there, but they couldn't get at in the past.
Now, when I hear about fracking in the news, it seems like there are only two perspectives. The first being that fracking is basically the devil. It causes drinking water to be flammable. There are serious health issues associated for the local communities. I hear about industry groups being just massive bullies who force towns into green lighting fracking projects. And then on the other side of that, it's the opposite. It's towns that bring in fracking projects are experiencing these wonderful economic booms. There's zero unemployment. Everyone is thriving and thrilled and such. So would you say that's a fair summation of how this debate stands publicly?
I think the public debate is polarized in the way that you describe. And frankly, that polarization and quite a bit of misinformation is the reason that the Center for Science and Democracy that I lead at Union of Concerned Scientists decided with some of our other programs and with partners at UCLA to hold a public forum and a set of expert working groups. And we decided to develop a research report and a community toolkit around this issue. That reason is that people are hearing the polarized debate, but actually being able to access information that is less polarized and more objective. And to be able to ask questions that concern them is really how these kinds of public policy decisions should be made. So in the United States, the public policy decisions are at really all levels of government. There are federal issues, although there are lots of constraints there. There are state-level decisions being made, and there are local-level decisions being made. And so citizens have a right in our democracy to engage with all of those levels of government. And to do that effectively, many people have questions. I mean, is it all good or bad is not a particularly useful answer if you're trying to decide what's best for your community and what's best for your family. So there's no question that there are boom towns for oil or gas. There's no question that there is a real energy boom going on in many parts of the country that's changed the energy economy. There's also no question that there are serious risks to air, water, community health that need to be addressed. There's also climate-related issues that need to be considered. So all of these things, you know, are much more complicated than the polarized debate. And our goal was to try to give people access to better information. There's lots of things that go into people's decisions about the direction society should go in their communities or nationally. But one of the pieces of information should be, what do we know scientifically about, you know, the impacts, the economic impacts, the social impacts, the environmental impacts, the public health impacts, positive and negative, of this kind of industrial development.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm talking about fracking with Andrew Rosenberg, the director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Okay, well, let's talk about what we do know and what we don't know, starting with the science. So according to that report that the Union of Concerned Scientists put out, independent and objective fracking data is limited. And I know that from trying to research this. So how so? Why is it so limited?
Well, this is a really important part of the discussion. Again, there are important decisions to be made. There are public policy decisions to be made. But the information available is very limited, and that is because there is no real monitoring requirement. There is no real analysis requirement of what, you know, starting conditions or baselines, as scientists would say, for things like water quality, air quality, and other, you know, environmental issues, as well as the social and economic issues. There is no requirement to either collect or, if the information is collected, to provide that data publicly. And that's because the regulatory system, again, speaking about the United States, is largely at the state level and largely does not require companies that are obtaining a permit to drill, even on private land, to collect that data before they begin operations or to collect it during operations. And even on public land, the requirements are rather minimal. The industry has been very effective at gaining exemptions from principal environmental laws at the federal level, including laws such as the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and so on, so that the analysis by federal agencies or the requirements to provide information under federal rules are really not being applied for fracking. And they're only, even on federal land, they're only being applied in a limited fashion. At the state level, many of those requirements seem to also be waived, although there are some places that are requiring more monitoring data. So the industry does not have to provide such information before proceeding, and that's one of our biggest concerns. It's not drawing the conclusion this is all bad or this is all good. It's that there isn't a clear path for obtaining really good information. So what we have is a set of studies, and in some cases a set of incidents that give indications about what some of the benefits and some of the risks of this kind of industrialization are. And further to that, even when there are incidents on things such as water contamination and the like, the industry has been very effective at quickly settling those and requiring confidentiality, so that if somebody believes that their water has been contaminated and they object to the industry settles on the condition that you never reveal any information, any data, or even talk about the fact that there was any problem on your land or on adjacent land or whatever. And so that has effectively stifled information flow on any problem areas. Those are two of the major barriers to information.
Now, one of the reasons that they're able to get these kinds of exemptions is due to being a trade secret, correct? The specific chemical compositions are considered a trade secret?
Well, the chemicals that are used in, combined with water, in the injected fracking fluid, in some cases are a trade secret. In other words, companies are saying, well, what we actually do is important for our business competitiveness. So if we are required to reveal that, then we are losing competitiveness, which, you know, I'm not an attorney, so the arguments over whether that's justifiable or not, we could discuss at length, but, you know, it's a legal question. But the trade secret protections are really quite uneven around the country. So some places require companies to state what's in the fracking fluid. Other places require companies to state what's in the fracking fluid only after they've used it,
right?
Which is also what the federal rules are leaning towards, which a little hard to understand. But, you know, after you've done it, you say, well, this is what I've just done. And some other places don't require any disclosure at all. So in some cases, you have virtually adjacent states where one state will say it's a trade secret and the next state will say, no, it's not, so that the information has already been revealed, but it's still maintained as secret in a particular location in the first state, which also doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I mean, once you've revealed it, then any competitiveness issues are gone. And in addition to that, there's only a few companies that are providing fracking fluid to all of these operators anyway, so who they're shielding it from is unclear. On the other hand, the issue of what's in the injection fluid is really only part of the story, and I think there's probably been more attention to that than perhaps is warranted. Really, what matters from it does matter for public health and safety, but what matters more from my perspective for public health and safety is the so-called produced water, the fluid that comes back up the well after they've broken up the rock, which contains some of the fracking fluid, but also contains lots of other things from deep underground, including arsenic and in some cases radium, and in some cases lots of salts and so on. And then what you do with that fluid is quite concerning.
Okay, so industry is under isn't necessarily under any compunction to share that data. But is there any way for researchers to get that data independently?
No.
Right.
It is the short answer. Now, many members of the industry, many companies voluntarily put some information on a publicly accessible website called FracFocus, which is discussed in the report. But that information is essentially a list of chemicals, not the actual volumes, nor the
right.
mix or anything else. And so, frankly, to me, I look at it and it's basically like somebody handing me, you know, a major chemistry textbook and saying it's in here somewhere. And, you know, it's a very long list of chemicals, but it doesn't tell you what's used and in what proportions or volumes at any particular locale. So that provides some information. Since much of this is this work is going on private land under lease agreements with landholders, then it has to be by agreement of the company that holds that lease to allow researchers in to investigate what's going on, sample fluid, and so on, as long as it's within the leasehold site. And in most cases, companies have not been allowing that kind of access.
Okay, so we're working with very little scientific information, very little empirical
yes.
data. What we do,
I mean, there is some, but mm-hmm. But yes, it's relatively little considering the scale of the operations.
Right. So what we have to work on is a lot of anecdotal evidence.
Yes.
So there are a lot of stories about the negative effects of fracking on an individual and community level. Are there any documented, well-supported cases of people's health being affected by fracking sites? And
well,
I realize you mentioned that those settlement agreements make it difficult for that to get out into the public sphere.
Right, and that's a really important issue. These kinds of confidentiality agreements make it very difficult for people to get out into the public sphere. There have been a number of cases where there have been reported incidents of water contamination or other health impacts, either animal health or human health. I'm hesitating because you said well-documented.
Right.
And in many cases, it's extremely hard to document these cases other than the initial report. In a few cases, unfortunately, there have been clear reports from a number of areas in Pennsylvania, in Texas, in Wyoming, water contamination. The Environmental Protection Agency in the United States began an investigation and then withdrew from the investigation or handed it over to the state level. And the only justifiable reason for that I can see is intense lobbying pressure. They have been under enormous pressure to back off. So, for example, in the case of in Wyoming, they began an investigation of reported water pollution. They proceeded for a little while and then abruptly said, well, actually, we're going to turn this over to the state, who turned it over to the company that was actually being investigated for contaminating, and said the company will do the investigation.
And no conflict of interest there at all.
No, conflict of interest. No concerns about independence there at all. Similar things have happened again in Pennsylvania and Texas. So there are great concerns, but there again are reports of public health and environmental impacts. But it's very difficult to pursue those. There are good studies that methane levels in water, in well water, in regions where fracking are going on, is higher. Those studies from Duke University and collaborators, are well done statistically, statistical sampling, good analyses, even though they've been disputed by industry. At least what I've seen from the statistical point of view is quite compelling that there's higher methane levels in the water. That it's not clear that there, it might make the water unpleasant, doesn't necessarily mean that it's got an immediate public health impact. That's where you, if there's high methane levels in the water, that's where you get people saying, you know, they can turn, light their water on fire kind of thing.
Oh, and we're going to talk about that specific issue right after the break. This is Science for the People, and we'll be back with more on fracking with Andrew Rosenberg from the Union of Concerned Scientists after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and today I'm joined by Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about a report their organization put out titled Toward an Evidence-Based Fracking Debate, Science, Democracy, and Community Right to Know in Unconventional Oil and Gas Development. Okay, so from the very little information we do have, what do we know? Let's start with water. How does fracking affect water, for example?
So there's two sets of issues with water. The first one is very important in water-challenged areas, those that where water supply is always difficult, particularly in the Intermountain West and the West Coast in the U.S., and that is just the quantity of water that's used. Now, this is less of an issue in some other areas that are relatively water-rich, but the quantity of water used can really be large, and, of course, there's a lot of demand for agriculture, for drinking water, for other uses. And that quantity per well can be, millions of gallons of water used intensively for a short period of time. It's not sort of a continual flow, but when the well is fracked, and a single well can be fracked multiple times. And an organization called CERES has done an analysis of water use and where that actually is causing problems. And there have been press reports, for example, in Texas, of towns actually running out of water because so much had been diverted to fracking operations. So that's one impact. A second impact is there contamination of either surface water or drinking water? Surface water contamination would result from spills of whatever fluid. You know, it's an industrialized site. There's transport over roads by tanker trucks of, various things, including the fracking fluid itself, oil in other cases, and so on. Those spills and runoff can be a problem. The water that comes back up out of the well, the produced water, needs to be stored or needs to be transported away at some point. The fate of that water, either, again, due to accidents, but also, where will it be disposed of, is at least potentially a risk to surface water and, in some cases, to drinking water. Most people have thought about the impacts on aquifers and drinking water from the well itself, and that really is only likely if the well is improperly sealed, which is hopefully a rare occurrence and is something that should be carefully monitored and is fixable. In other words, that the well itself is leaking at places where it's not supposed to leak, because the fracking operation, the horizontal drilling, is very far below the actual water table or aquifers. So if the well itself isn't sealed properly, there can be some leakage of contaminants. And hopefully, again, that's a rare occurrence. But more of a concern is that water that's brought back up, where it's disposed of, whether it's carefully contained, and so on. And then the final issue is whether this is all to move, in many cases, natural gas to areas that can be collected, but you're creating cracks in the rock, and sometimes those cracks will increase, either create or increase the amount of methane migration into water supplies. And so does it increase the amount of methane gas in the water? When people report cloudy water, sometimes that's a result of increased methane. There have been some studies that show that there are higher levels of methane around fracking sites than in areas where fracking isn't occurring, where there should, equivalent kind of geology. So all of those things are concerns on water supply.
But you did not mention the flammable drinking water. But we've all seen those videos.
So the flammable drinking water issue is effectively that there's a lot of methane, natural gas, migration into the water supply. People are then pumping up the water. It has a higher methane content, and that methane either needs to be vented off or In some cases, people have claimed that it's actually flammable. Now, the famous video, as I understand it, is actually being able to light the vent pipe, not the water hose itself, that's coming out of somebody's well. That is an attempt to vent off that methane. But it's a pretty high level of methane, and yeah, methane burns, or natural gas burns. That's why we use it as an energy supply. And so when natural gas levels in the water are elevated, then the concern is that that creates a danger, or it could build up in a house if it's not properly vented, and so on. It is true that in many areas there already is methane leakage and methane in the water. The real question is, when you stimulate a well by fracking, are you increasing the methane in the water? And it's not a big stretch of the imagination to think that, yeah, well, if you've stimulated it so the methane will move around, or the natural gas will move around, some of it's going to move into the water supply. And that's what the studies from Rob Jackson and others at Duke have shown. So it's not completely fiction, but people shouldn't think that they turn on the tap and it bursts into flames. It's more that the venting of that gas can be a real concern.
Now, what about air quality? Do we know how fracking affects it?
Well, again, the information is hard to come by because there isn't a requirement for monitoring in most places. One of my staff was at a meeting at the academy where, you know, the EPA said they had been monitoring air quality around a set of fracking wells and found very high levels of methane as well as volatile organic compounds in the air. But the Texas Environmental Agency said, well, we had air monitors there and we saw absolutely no change. They had completely different results, to which there was a little bit of an argument. And the people from the EPA said, did you turn your monitoring instruments on? Because it seemed bizarre. I mean, they had an absolutely flat line, no change at all. And so it is unclear, but certainly there have again been a number of reports, and there's every reason to think that there is a chance for increased air pollution. There also is unquestionably increased air pollution because of the truck traffic. Fracking sites are, first of all, they have to build it, then they have to bring in the fluid, they have to transport wastewater out, they have to transport the product out. So you can have thousands of trucks on small country roads. And increased truck traffic comes along with increased big diesel engines. The wells themselves have big diesel engines. There's plenty of air pollution that comes from just that increase in activity, as well as leakage from the any potential leakage of VOCs and other things from the wells. So all of these things are a concern. Again, we would say, why isn't there required monitoring in place? I mean, why would you say that these operations shouldn't have to meet the air quality standards that other facilities do, but they are exempt from those Clean Air Act provisions that would require at the federal level, those kinds of protections?
You know, we only touched on water and air, and you cover a lot of other potential risks in your report, but you also talk about risk versus benefit, and not just risk versus benefit, but risk perception, because humans have a hard time with risk perception.
The important thing to us is that we fairly recognize that risks are possible. You know, the environmental risks and public health risks we've discussed, the impacts on communities of this sort of major level of activity, and some of those, there's no question there's positive impacts, you know, jobs and economic activity. But reports that say, well, this is all benefit, or that it's all, you know, it's all bad, are not presenting complete information to the public. So, for example, recently the American Petroleum Institute contracted IHS, which is a big international consulting firm, to produce a report on all the wonderful benefits of fracking in natural gas for the energy economy, with no mention that there were any societal costs at all, with the conclusion that if there were any regulations, effectively, that would put the entire American economy at risk. With no information at all, not even a mention that, you know, there are serious public health and community concerns that need to be dealt with. Those are costs that will be borne by the public. So that when you're doing an economic analysis, it was like reporting a baseball score where you say it's the Yankees 3. End of story. you know, it's impossible to evaluate when you only report one side of the story. And that's just a mistake in making public policy decisions. People have a right to better information than that. Yes, there may be these economic benefits. There are these concerns. Many of the jobs are transient jobs with people coming from other places because you can't move into, you know, a rural area in, you know, some part of the country and assume that there's going to be a ready supply of experienced oil workers in that area. So they're going to be brought in from other parts of the country because you need an experienced workforce. So many of the jobs that go to local people are the lower level jobs. They may well be quite transient. There are all kinds of claims of all the other jobs that will be produced with massive numbers coming out of the numbers jobs that will be produced, much like the Keystone Pipeline debate of, you know, millions of jobs and so on. But when you actually look at the numbers, it's, well, no, actually it's thousands, or maybe actually it's only a few thousand, and they'll only last for a short period of time. So you need a fairer analysis of this stuff that is not to make a particular policy point, but is to give people information.
Do we have any long-term studies on any of these areas, the scientific or the economic?
No. I mean, we don't. We don't have comprehensive data because there isn't a requirement to collect it. I mean, there isn't even a requirement to do an environmental impact analysis for, you know, the usual environmental impact statement that in all of the areas that I've worked was required for things that related to receiving a federal permit or at the state level a permit for any major action. That those requirements don't exist for, because again, there are exemptions in place that allow oil and gas to go forward, usually with just, you know, permitting actions. So an environmental impact statement would require somebody proposing to develop an oil field to analyze the so-called affected environment, and it would require them to propose different ways that they could develop that oil field, including the option of not developing it at all, and analyze the impacts of doing that from an environmental perspective as well as a social and economic perspective, which is a well-developed system. It's laborious, but it certainly is a well-developed system in most areas of environmental concern.
You're tuned in to Science for the People. I'm talking about fracking with Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. So something that we really haven't spoken about is the media around fracking issues. It seems to be fairly awful, doesn't it? Is that your impression?
I would say that there have been some very good reports. There's a series, a National Public Radio series called State Impact, which I think has been very useful. There's been some great reporting, you know, individual reporters that have, Tom Wilbur has done a good book and a blog series that has been very informative. But, you know, the broader media has actually been pretty limited. If you pay attention to this stuff, which of course we are because of the reporting work that we've been doing, there's a continual flow of stories, which actually in many cases are informative on both sides. But in terms of the main media sort of front page headlines, it's very much treated as a local issue. And unfortunately, at a political level, again, within the United States, it's been dealt with by politicians as, you know, here's all the positives, and we really, by many politicians, I should say, not all, here's all the positives, and we really don't want to think about whether there's any concerns. I mean, in one congressional hearing, members of Congress actually referred to or made the point that the states were doing a perfect job of managing oil and gas and fracking operations, and there was no need for any federal involvement. Well, you know, even if they were doing a pretty good job, I was an environmental manager for the government. You never do a perfect job.
Well, speaking of hyperbole, It seems like, to a certain extent, both sides have their own extremes, obviously, and both sides are presenting certain areas as being certainties when they really aren't. So let's talk about one of those, the movie Gasland.
Yep.
What was your impression of its accuracy?
Well, I mean, again, it was a mixture. It was making a point, but it was, and many of the things that were portrayed and are portrayed in Gasland are real anecdotal events. but in some cases they're presented as if this is the rule rather than an anecdotal event.
Right.
And, you know, similarly, the industry report that I referred to before and many other industry reports are industry-funded studies by really conflicted analysts who are being paid by the industry to come up with a particular answer, it appears. It's not that there's no information there. It's just presented in a way where it's hard for somebody to step back and say, okay, what does this mean for me? And you're right. It's on both sides that people are emphasizing the points that they want to emphasize. And that's all part of the political debate. But what we don't have is a clear requirement for basic information. You know, what is happening over the long term to water quality, surface water, environmental impacts, air quality, community level social impacts. You know, what happens when you are running 1,000 trucks a day through a small community? What happens when you bring in, you know, hundreds of workers for a 3-month period to a small town? What happens to the character of that town? You know, what happens when you're drilling on one piece of land, but the neighbor doesn't get a lease, or either because they don't want to or it's not accessible, that's not where the company wants to go, so you know, the person who is the leaseholder is making quite a lot of money, but the neighbors are not. Why aren't we looking at those things as a society and saying, okay, these are important issues that we want to make sure that we at least consider and address the risks, because there are real risks. I mean, you know, if you're using oil and gas, there are risks. There are everything from climate risks down to local level risks. So let's address them squarely. That's what a democracy should do.
Well, while we're all trying to hopefully reform the entire political system,
yeah.
What can people do in the meantime? How are people that potentially, let's say, live in those communities where somebody, where industry or the township is proposing a fracking project, where can they go for objective information? Is there anywhere that you can suggest?
We produced what's called a community toolkit, which is not designed to tell people this is what you should think, but it is designed to suggest questions that people may want to ask, depending on where they live and what their communities are confronting and what they as individuals are most interested in. And so when we ask what can people do, it's they actually should ask questions and demand answers from their public officials and from companies, and not simply say, well, that I don't have the information, I just guess it'll all be okay. You know, they need to ask their local officials and their state officials and their federal elected officials. They need to express their concerns and say, you know, I want to know about this. I am concerned about this. There are, in our community toolkit, resources where you can look for information that we believe is more objective, and also some guidance for how you would judge. I mean, you need to know when a study is cited by, you know, your congressman, where did it come from? And was it produced by the industry? And was it objective? And, you know, did it have the right level of review? And do you understand what potential conflicts might come in? And so on. I think it's incredibly important for people to actually demand that their public officials and the companies that are working within their communities provide them answers. This doesn't mean that everybody should become a scientist. It means that, you know, people have justifiable concerns and they should expect better information. I mean, why? If you asked your state official, will there be monitoring of air quality in my community? Well, if the answer is no, you might want to pursue that. Where are they going to take the wastewater? How will it be disposed of? What will be the protections in place if, you know, as trucks travel over the road? What happens if there's an accident? Do you have a plan in place for first responders? And we didn't talk about it, but one of the issues on what's in the fracking fluid is, suppose there's an accident and a first responder has to go, you know, that somebody is injured or they have to go to a cleanup site. They need to know what they're dealing with. The doctor in the local hospital needs to know what could possibly be the sources of contamination if there, you know, hopefully there aren't accidents, but sorry to say accidents happen. So, you know, having those plans in place are something that communities really should expect. So there is important ways that people should engage locally. And at a national level, I think we should expect the same thing. because we know that national resources are, you know, we want national resources to be brought to bear to for the health and safety, not only of ourselves, but of our fellow citizens. That's what we expect in the society. And this isn't a great leap, you know, of reforming the entire political system. That's what we've come to expect over time in the U.S. and in democratic countries around the world.
And we are almost out of time. So what would you like to leave people with, sir?
I would like people to really focus on the idea that there are some positive there's positive news that comes out of this change in the energy economy. We haven't talked about the climate issues, and there's serious concerns with continuing to use fossil fuels. We should be moving away from fossil fuels. But given that natural gas resources will be used not only for energy but also for industrial uses like plastics, which is another whole topic, we should directly confront the risks. We should not pretend that there are no risks. We should directly confront those and use the tools that we have available in governance at all levels to manage those risks and to minimize them. And that to do that, the public needs to speak out. Elected officials are good at responding to their constituents. So their constituents need to speak and say, look, I'm in favor of this, but these are serious concerns. Or I'm opposed to this, and these are serious concerns. It's fine to be on both sides of the debate. But we all have a common interest in getting better information.
Andrew, as always, thank you very much for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll link to Andrew Rosenberg at the Union of Concerned Scientists and their report on fracking on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. This is Science for the People, and we'll be back to speak with science librarian John Dupuy to talk about some contentious Canadian science library closures after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at population and politics and what we can do to make human life on Earth more sustainable. We'll speak to journalist and author Alan Weissman about his book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And we're joined by Dr. Chris Tyler, director of the UK's Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, to talk about the top 20 things scientists need to know about policymaking. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with John Dupuy, who is a science librarian at York University in Toronto. He's also the blogger behind Confessions of a Science Librarian, where his main interests lately are open access and the state of science in Canada. Welcome back to the show, John.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Now, the last time you were on the show, it was to talk about the Harper government's war on science, and that was the episode that basically almost sent me into the fetal position. So, thank you.
Yeah, I remember that one. And you know, we're not talking about anything much more cheerful today.
That's great. So, no, it hasn't gotten any better. Since we're calling it a war, let's talk about the latest attack. Please do tell us about the library closures.
It's happening with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. As you can imagine, this kind of environmentally based science is very information intensive, and the federal government had a very extensive network of 11 science libraries basically spread across the country from, you know, literally from coast to coast. So 11 libraries, and what was announced, what was kind of included in a budget about a year or so ago was the consolidation, was the closing and consolidation of these libraries. So what they've done is they've closed all but four. In other words, they've closed seven libraries, and so two large libraries remain and two smaller ones. And of course, what happened is this just happened, you know, this was a bolt from the blue, and it was done very, very poorly.
They're fisheries libraries, so what kind of information are in these libraries?
It would be a wide range. There would be just regular science books, the kinds of things, you know, standard texts on, you know, geology and biology and environmental science and biochemistry and fish biology, all that kind of stuff. So there'd be a lot of kind of standard books. But more importantly, these libraries would be filled with special research reports. So in other words, team of scientists get sent out into the field to do a study on acidity in a particular lake. Well, they would write up a report, and that report would be at one of these particular kinds of libraries. And even more importantly, the raw data that they would have collected while they were doing that study of the lake would also be in the library. So there would be these reports, right, which would be, you know, 10 pages, 100 pages. They'd be fairly thin, what we call in the library business gray literature. In other words, not peer-reviewed, but kind of research reports. Right. But there would also be binders and binders and binders of essentially raw data. And so this information goes back literally decades and decades. So there would be a huge historical library, a huge historical well of data about lakes in Canada. And so if you wanted to do a study now on one of these particular lakes, well, you could say, oh, what was happening in that lake in, you know, 1970? What was happening in 1950? And that information would be there. That's what the fear is. The fear is that this consolidation was done very poorly, very rushed, and no one's really been paying attention to whether or not those kinds of unique materials have been preserved. Because libraries, we do weeding. We do cull our collections, right? You know, most libraries aren't getting physically bigger anymore. So when new stuff comes in, we got to get rid of old stuff. I mean, there are those pictures you see of the dumpsters full of books. I mean, any librarian worth her or his salt has filled the dumpsters with books. It's just what we do. We have to make space for new stuff. So we work with our communities and we weed the old stuff. But we're hearing stories about, you know, basically people going into these libraries, filling up boxes of stuff of who knows what, and just walking away with them. And that's how they've done the weeding and the culling. And so it's just kind of crazy. You know, the problem is, the problem isn't that they've culled their collections. The problem isn't that they're closing these libraries. That's happening at academic universities too, where systems that have 10 or 20 different branch libraries are consolidating their libraries and closing some of the smaller, less used branches. So these are things that are, you know, these are things that libraries and librarians just do. But when we do them, you know, we want to do them properly. If we're consolidating a huge system of libraries into just one or two libraries, well, that's a big job. You have to do it really carefully, and that's what we don't know. We don't know that they've done it carefully. And from everything we're hearing, we're pretty sure that they haven't.
Well, what was the rationale behind all this in the first place?
I mean, I guess there's a surface rationale, and then there's the conspiracy theory rationale, right?
Ooh, let's start with reality.
So the reality is that they wanted to save money. Not much, about $500,000 a year. So most of these libraries would have been really small with just like one or two staff members. And so they did lay off, you know, in the weird way of human resources, they laid off 9.7 people. So closing 7 units and laying off around 10 people, again, really small places. Perhaps some of these places didn't even have one full-time person dedicated to them. So they're saving about $500,000 a year. And that we know because there was a memo that was leaked that said how much that how many people they've laid off and how much they expect to save. So yes, so the surface rationale is to save money. And, you know, again, people aren't necessarily using these kinds of physical libraries the way they used to. Partly also because since 9/11, you can't just walk into one of these libraries. You have to get a security clearance and be accompanied by a staff member. So it's, you know, if you or I wanted to go to one of these government libraries, you can't just kind of knock on the door and go in. Although apparently when they were doing their, collection clean out, yes, you could just walk in with a box and take all the stuff you wanted.
Can this information be found other places at this point?
Well, that's one of the things we just really don't know. So, for example, all the regular books that they've culled out of their collection, none of those would be unique. And so if there was some standard biology textbook or some standard chemistry textbook, really, that's not the kind of thing I'm worried about. The stuff that I'm worried about is those kinds of unique research reports. And they say they want to digitize that stuff. They say they want to make it available electronically. But again, this is one of those things where, you know, they have this plan, but no one can see it. You know, it's almost like they retroactively decided, oh yeah, we need to come up with a plan to keep people happy on this one. It's easy to say you're going to digitize and make things available, digitize these unique materials and make them available. But again, you know, you have to have a plan. You have to have these materials need to be made, you know, very, very discoverable. So they need to have good metadata. They're materials that have a really long, useful life, right? A research document on a particular lake is just as useful in 100 or 200 years as it is now. Well, and so these things need to be preserved, they need to be accessible, they need to be discoverable, and you don't just come up with a plan like this on the back of an envelope. And again, this is why it's kind of problematic for us that we don't, in the library community, that we don't know what's going on. That's why it's problematic for us that they've laid off, really, the experts in building and maintaining these collections, right? All the internal librarians and other library staff, because we just don't know. They say that they've offered materials to the various university libraries, in Newfoundland and Manitoba and other places. But again, we hear that, we don't really know.
Let's try on the conspiracy theory.
Okay, well, it's a pretty obvious conspiracy theory. The conspiracy theory here is that they did this because there's stuff that they really would prefer people not to know. And a lot of the stuff that they would prefer people not to know is stuff about the environment, is stuff about these lakes, stuff about fish, stuff about ecosystems. Because if you're in the pocket of the big oil companies, anything that's inconvenient to that agenda is certainly information that you don't want to be widely known. To me, this one, I'm a little bit bigger on the whole incompetence thing on this one. It seems too poorly done to have been on purpose. I have to say, I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories that I would believe about this particular government, but like I said, this one seems kind of too poorly planned. It looks like it's just incompetence.
This is what I'm very curious about, because it seems that we don't hear a lot of science stories in the media, but I will tell you this, that the closure of the fisheries libraries is everywhere. People that are not interested in science at all know what I'm talking about when I mention this.
Yeah, and people that aren't interested in libraries either.
Exactly.
And I think there's a couple, why this story? Why has this story become so viral against really all odds when they did way worse things to the National Library?
Absolutely.
And we talked about this in the first time I was on your show in the summer. We've done way worse things to the Library and Archives Canada. Vastly worse things. Horrible things. But somehow that wasn't a story. Why this? And I think there's two reasons. I think when they did these things to Library and Archives Canada over the course of, like, say, last year, the early part of last year and the year before, I don't think we were quite as ready to be so pissed off at the Conservatives yet as a society. They'd only just really gotten their majority government. They'd really only started to roll on this kind of anti-evidence agenda. In one sense, we weren't ready to be so thoroughly pissed off at them. And I think the other thing is A, we're ready to be pissed off, and B, this is so transparently, again, maybe this, here's where the conspiracy theory comes in. This is so transparently about the environment.
Right.
It's so transparently about, we have to exploit those natural resources to the maximum potential, and any information that's going to contradict that, we need to figure out a way to downplay that. So I think that's why this story has gone viral, because, like I said, we're just ready to be pissed off. That big story on the Fifth Estate this past week, and again, it just plays into all those things that we very strongly suspect.
Well, maybe you want to just back up and explain the Fifth Estate story for anybody who...
CBC has a current affairs documentary show called The Fifth Estate that does long reports on current interesting topics. And this past Friday, they aired this thing that they called Silence of the Labs. And it was actually an excellently done documentary about, again, all these kinds of issues, how people that are trying to do evidence-based work on the environment and other things like that have been silenced pretty systematically by the federal government. And one of the big stories that they talked with David Schindler, who was the guiding light behind the Experimental Lakes Area. Mm-hmm. And again, which is, you have to figure that the Experimental Lakes Area, there's a lot of material that would be relevant in those DFO libraries. It was a very good show. I think it's well worth. Fortunately, the CBC does archive all their shows, so it's easy to track online.
Everybody should go watch that. So do you think that people are at a point where they're starting to pay attention to the fact that the government seems to take some issue with evidence and science and such? Because I don't think that people really registered that until probably the last year. It's starting to get a lot more media play.
Absolutely. And I think the big one was the omnibus bill, C-33, I think it was. And when we saw the fallout of that and all the different programs that were closed and the budgets that were cut. And so, yes, I think we're starting to see all those years of minority government, they were cautious. And now we're seeing them, you know, really advance on their agenda. And I guess that's one of the weaknesses of the Canadian system, is that when you have a majority government, you can pretty well do whatever you want. There isn't those kinds of checks and balances that I guess other systems can have.
Is there anything that you can see coming down the pipeline in terms of the government and science?
Even in this, I guess in the fall, I was kind of thinking to myself, we've seen the worst of it. What else could they do?
Right.
And so there's lots more that they can do. And I think what we're probably going to see over the course of the next 2 years is a concentration on from the science perspective on building the pipelines, the oil pipelines. So I think that's one thing that maybe we're going to hear a lot more about. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about how you have to organize yourself to make sure that from their perspective, the story that supports the pipelines gets told. And again, trying to suppress the evidence gathering capability on the other side. And I think a lot of that has to do as well with climate science and ecology. So I think those are the things that we're going to see happening over the course of the next couple of years. You know, are we going to see any big story, any single big story like this one? Who knows? From their point of view, it's the low-hanging fruit. The easy wins are gone, and the things that are going to cause big controversies are already done. Now it's the subtle things, right? There's the Minister of State for Science and Technology, Greg Rickford, is doing these consultations about a new science policy for Canada. And they really downplay government and academic science and really play up this idea that science and innovation is all about doing stuff for business. But again, that's the kind of thing that hugely important to people in the science community, the people doing science, but is the kind of thing that tends not to get a huge play, I guess, in the media. Because, of course, why wouldn't people want science to be about jobs?
Exactly. Which is fair.
Right. Which is fair enough, but again, it's kind of about balance, right? You don't want to go too far in either direction. It looks like right now what the government would like is government science to do the research that business doesn't want to do. In other words, what's happened with the NRC, the National Research Council, over the course of the last year or so. In other words, becoming kind of that handmaiden or concierge to business on the one hand. And on the other hand, things we're seeing, thousands of government sciences at DFO and other departments being let go. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to push that kind of science out of the government as well, with the idea that academia can pick that up.
Right.
Right. So we're seeing this kind of, what we're seeing is this really comprehensive reordering of priorities in how the government wants to do science, both internally and how they would like to shape the way that other sectors do science as well. In other words, the academic sector and the corporate sector.
Now, how is that problematic?
It's one of those things in degree. Industry should do the research, should pay for their own research. There's no reason why we taxpayers should pay for the research and development that industry should be doing. You know, there's a balance there. There's no reason why the government can't work with businesses to make sure that, okay, there's some aspects of a different project that it might make more sense for the government to do because it doesn't directly pay off. So there's a balance there, but generally speaking, business should do their own research and development. And on the other hand, right, if the government, you know, stuff that's about the food supply, water supply, the environment, the stuff that government has traditionally done, that it seems that they're trying to push out into academia. Within academia, again, it's not so clear to me, you know, how the government gets academia to do exactly the things that they would like them to do. Mm-hmm. Because in academia, it's like herding cats, right? It's really hard to get people to do what you want them to do. So it's like they're trying to get out of these different areas, and it just doesn't work because like I said, when you're trying to push research that should be done by the government, like I said, about the environment, food supply, into academia, it's just hard to get those people in academia to do exactly what you want. The reward structures, the funding structures, it's just completely different.
Thank you, as always. We enjoy you, even though you You vaguely traumatize me every time you're on the show.
We'll have to figure out a way to get me on for a happy topic.
You can find John Dupuy at the link on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes for all your Science for the People needs. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.